is at my back. We're heading down the river, ain't no turning back.
Okay, welcome to the second edition of the Nameless Security Podcast. I'm Dennis Fisher, the executive editor of SearchSecurity.com and Information Security Magazine. Our first episode last week with Gary McGraw was a big success, and I think we're well on our way to complete domination of the media world now. But that success also means that the pressure is on for our second guest to live up to the standard that Gary set. I have a suspicion he's probably up to the task, though. This is the first live on-location edition of the podcast, and it's fitting that it's here in Las Vegas for the Black Hat Conference. Black Hat's probably my favorite event on the annual conference calendar for a bunch of reasons, mainly because it's light on the kind of corporate vendor fluff that is all over most shows like RSA and others, but also because it has some of the best technical presentations and the most entertaining speakers. So our guest today is Dino Dizovi, a security researcher who also has a day job as an information security officer for a financial services company in New York. Dino is well known in the search in the research community for his work on Macintosh security issues, as well as for his research on virtualized rootkits and virtualization security problems. Before taking his current job, Dino worked at security consultancy At Stake, Bloomberg, and also at Montesano Security. Dino, thanks for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what have you seen here this week that was really interesting? Anything that really stuck out to you so far?
Notably for me was the presentation on how to impress girls with memory protection bypasses in web browsers by Mark Dowd and Alex Sodaroff. I think that was one of the bombs that was dropped at this year's conference, showing how they discovered a lot of ways in which browser vulnerabilities or vulnerabilities in web browsers can now be trivially exploitable, even on Windows Vista with address space layout randomization, hardware data execution prevention, safe SEH. I mean, basically all of the protections that Microsoft has implemented in Windows Vista, Server 2008, because of the extensive plugin architecture of web browsers, all these protections have been obliterated. And so vulnerabilities are now almost actually easier to exploit now with these techniques than they were in 2001 before these techniques were implemented.
Is this just things that Microsoft didn't anticipate when they were building these products, or is this just really tremendous work by these guys finding ways into these things?
I think it's actually both. One thing that the speakers did concede is they said all these technologies do a great job of stopping server exploits. And that was basically when these were being developed, those were the dominant problem. And what they're highlighting is just that the problem has changed, and now web browser exploits are the dominant security threat, for most consumers, for malware and adware and everything like that. And basically, it's just we don't really know how to make a secure browser yet. And so both Internet Explorer and Firefox are re-implementing, changing their architecture, changing how their interfaces are presented to users so the user can make better security decisions. And this is just one area where we need to think about, how to build a secure browser.
And are there good ways for Microsoft or Mozilla to go about sort of re-architecting these things right now? Or is this these things that they're going to have to address down the line in like further releases? These aren't vulnerabilities per se. These are just architectural issues that these guys found a way to exploit.
Exactly. There are some things that Microsoft can do now that they can change the behavior to make some of these attacks or some of these techniques not as effective. But they presented 30 techniques that all yield the same ramifications, and there's no way Microsoft can just patch these quickly. These require big architectural changes that may involve changes to the operating system, involve Adobe making changes in Flash, Sun making changes in Java, and none of these are trivial. And these are things that will probably be with us for the next 3 to 4 years.
We talked a little bit about this next topic a few weeks ago when I saw you in New York City, but I wanted to go into some of the hysteria that's around virtualization and security right now. Can you talk a little bit about why the technological problems with virtualization aren't necessarily the real issue, and it's maybe sort of the organizational problems that are more of an issue when you're talking about virtualization?
Yeah, this came up in our panel discussion a while ago, and I think Chris Hoff also mentions this in his presentation, where the problem is finding the virtual machines. We have a lot of technology to track hardware machines and make sure that our hardware, servers and appliances have high availability and things like this, and our VMs don't have this yet. And just very basic things of, okay, so this given server or IP address is it a VM or is it a real host? If it's a VM, what host is it on? And how do I know that it'll always be on that VM server? You know, it could basically be, you know, vMotions to another one. You don't know where it is. And this just requires some retraining of IT staff to basically think in this way, because, you know, a lot of staffs are, you know, really adept at knowing where the servers are and are very attached to the physical conception of the machine, you know, that the hardware is a personality characteristic of the mail server. And with virtualization, you need to, you know, pull yourself away from that.
Is part of the problem that people are deploying virtualization before they've really thought about all the ramifications and the ways that it can affect their environment and their organization?
I think so. I mean, like, largely you have a pressure from above because they've, you know, managers have read that virtualization will save money, save power, it'll just consolidate. And so they're pushing this on the IT staff saying, you know, we need to do this, we need to jump on it, you know, and make use of this as soon as possible. And unfortunately, there isn't currently some best practices on how to manage this well. And you see things like people putting virtual machines from different security domains on the same VM server, and not really thinking that the virtual machine isolation is enough to protect them, when in some cases it may not be.
I know you do a lot of work on Macs. Do you see some point in the not too distant future where Macs are going to have a serious presence in the enterprise, and the IT staffs are going to sort of have to learn to deal with the security problems of these Macs that they really don't know a whole lot about right now?
And that's one of the big open questions. When will we see Macs in the enterprise? And actually, now I believe that we'll see iPhones in the enterprise way sooner than we see Macs. I think basically, you know, although there's been studies, surveys have shown that Macs are now present in a majority of Fortune 500 organizations, they're not there yet in a commanding presence. But I think iPhone has a serious shot at being a contender to BlackBerries and Windows mobile devices. And so basically your mobile technology, you know, at a company will be BlackBerry, iPhone, and Windows CE. And basically that's where you'll have to start thinking about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think they said there's about 4,500 people at this show, and it seems like about 4,000 of them have iPhones. I mean, you have one, and just about everybody I've run into has an iPhone, and it's not just a phone. I mean, it's a computing platform, and HD and other people have done work on attack tools for this, and, you know, it seems like it's making its way into the enterprise, and people are going to have to learn how to deal with it pretty quickly. All right, let's talk a little bit about the research process, because I know you do a lot of security research. I think a lot of people think of security researchers as working in, you know, some sort of dark basement, you know, in some kind of black magic. Can you give us sort of an overview of how the process works when you decide you're going to sort of attack a problem and look for, you know, say some sort of vulnerability, whether it's in IE or whatever application you decide you want to look at? How do you start, and how does the process work?
Basically, I start by just researching, to use an overloaded term, reading about the technology, you know, trying to understand it as best I can at all levels, at the lowest level up to the, you know, how it's used typically. You know, you need to know from the high level, how is it used, how can it be used, and you need to know at the low level how it works. And then basically just applying kind of the attacker mindset to it and looking at what could go wrong, and, you know, if something could go wrong and that could be bad, how could I make that go wrong? And I think after you get practice thinking like this, you just, every new thing that comes out, you look at it and you're like, well, this might be a bad idea because of this. And for instance, when I was researching the virtualized rootkit stuff, I read about a lot of the specifications with hardware virtualization appearing in Intel processors. And also I read about the specifications for secure virtual machines that were going to be used for Microsoft's Palladium. And these were virtual machines that couldn't be touched by the running operating system. And I thought that would be a really bad situation for malware, that if malware could create itself in this VM that couldn't be touched, you'd have a bad, it'd be a really bad situation for the consumer. And so when I started looking at it, and also I got a MacBook with the Intel Core processor that could support this, and I really wanted to see what it could do. And I got the idea of, like, well, I think I could just take the running operating system and copy it into the virtual machine and run what used to be the real operating system as a VM copy of it, and turn the real operating system into a rootkit that controls it. And it's just kind of, you just kind of think about these things and, like, I wonder if it's possible. And then the hard part is actually making it happen. You know, I think, you know, it's pretty easy to sit and say, okay, this can happen, these are all the bad things that could happen. But the harder jobs are ranking them by what's more realistic, what could become a realistic threat. given just the technology and technological capabilities. For instance, with exploits, an exploit may be with a given vulnerability, an exploit may be simple or very complicated, and it may be very reliable or very unreliable, and you may have one opportunity to perform the attack or multiple, and all of these determine the risk of this vulnerability being used in malware or in a worm, because those require a vulnerability and an exploit with certain characteristics. And I think the hardest last thing with research is to find out, you know, what of these attacks and risks that you research will really affect people, you know, and really affect users. You know, one of the things that came out with the virtualized rootkits is that we haven't seen any of these in the wild, and we may not. I mean, it may be a thing that we thought would be a threat and it turns out not to be. However, it's usually good to be in a position where it's better to anticipate the threat and either decide to not react to it or add mitigations rather than be taken by surprise by it.
So what is the what's the feeling like when you find, you know, say a new vulnerability or a new attack technique and you think, all right, this is something nobody has found before. You know, this is something really new. You know, what's that feeling like? It's got to be pretty terrific feeling.
It's awesome. I mean, just having like for an attacker, like, or someone who does attack-oriented research, just destroying something in the most elegant and beautifully simple way possible, in a way that no one else has done, is an amazing feeling. And it's just very sad. It's very satisfying in its own way, just to kind of one-up something. And the way I look at security is, you always have the attack and the attackers and defenders, kind of, you know, each trying to do the cat and mouse game, like to one-up each other and like advance the state of the art. And yeah, it's just invigorating. And I talk to people who have gotten an amazing exploit, running. And like when I get my exploits running, like we all share the same feeling of you want to run it over and over and over again, just because it's like it worked. Oh my god, it worked.
Yeah, you could sort of see that on the faces of Mark Dowd and Alex Sodaroff, you know, in that session we just came from when they were sort of running the exploits and doing the demos. Just see the smiles on their faces, like, you know, look what we did. Yeah. Look how badly we broke everything that Microsoft spent a lot of time building, you know. Okay, so here's a kind of a loaded question, but given your background and all the sort of security knowledge you have, do you ever sort of sit there and daydream about, man, do you know what I could do with, you know, if I found some hackable server at XYZ Bank or something along those lines? I mean, how much thought do you give to sort of the dark side of things?
Honestly, I think there's actually two very different things. Basically, researching attacks and performing attacks are different mindsets. And you have this, you know, just to take a reference from popular culture, from James Bond, you have Q and you have James Bond. James Bond couldn't build any of the stuff that he did, but he pulls off all like the very flashy things. But Q is the one basically making all these amazing gadgets that make all that possible. And I think, you know, like for myself, my interest has always been in the challenge of developing and finding these attacks. And I feel like, you know, using them is actually just really boring. So, you know, also, you know, I find it, you know, I'm ethically opposed to, you know, doing that, but it's also boring. So
you've got kind of this dual role as a researcher and an enterprise security officer. In that sort of dual role, are there any attack scenarios or things that you think are coming down the line that really worry you, that sort of keep you up at night, the things that, you know, rattle around in your head and think, man, I really hope this doesn't happen at some point soon?
Inevitably, yes. I mean, I think perhaps I'm cursed by having the researcher gene, because what that means is I anticipate a lot of attacks. And so I see attacks at every possible scenario. And so when you're in an operational context, also you also have to balance the productive needs of the business. You have to know what you can do and basically make the determination of what should you defend against, you know, what risks should you accept, which ones should you mitigate. And being also, you know, an attack oriented researcher, you know, there's a lot of attacks that I'm thinking of virtualization attacks, you know, targeted malware, targeted exploits, and it's actually a lot of work to defend against those. And so I have to really switch modes to think about attacks and think about, given the current threat profile of the firm and the internet and, you know, anyone that would wish to do us harm, what is reasonable to do?
looking at the sort of threat landscape right now, and it looks like there's really a lot of professionalism that's sort of crept into the cybercrime world. The guys on the other side of the line really have gotten, you know, they have professional development organizations, they have QA, they have all of this kind of stuff, which is leading to a lot of, you know, really good malware being written, or, you know, effective malware being written. How far do you see that going? I mean, these guys are well funded. They're motivated because there's a lot of money in this. What's the next step here? I mean, are we going to be able to make any real dents in this cybercrime epidemic anytime soon?
I hope we can. And I think this will continue as long as it's economically profitable for them to do it. And as it becomes more profitable, more people get into it, their industry matures. And just like the rise of the defensive security industry, where initially it was just a bunch of people performing specialized security services, and then products and established companies and venture capital all came into it. You know, we're seeing the rise of an industry in malware, and, you know, becoming a more organized underground economy. And if you look at more established underground economies, they have more established structure, and because they've been around for a while. So you'll see the cybercrime economy start moving towards those models as well. I think the challenges are to fight the tactics and also fight the motivations, and figure out not just how to prevent the exploitation of vulnerabilities and, you know, installation of malware, but also fight, in a larger sense, the profitability of these enterprises. That's because that's the only way to truly stop it.
All right, great. I think that's it. Dino, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Dennis.
All right, that's going to do it for this second edition of the Still Nameless Security Podcast. I've gotten a couple of really good suggestions for names, but if you have one or a suggestion for a guest who you'd like to hear on the podcast, please send me an email at dfisher@techtarget.com. And for more information on security topics, please visit us at searchsecurity.com. Thanks very much, and we'd like to give our special thanks to Gary McGraw's band Where's Aubrey for our great intro and outro music. Thanks, and I'll talk to you all down the road.